Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 29th of July, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Paul Bosch, and he will be doing a session entitled Worship, Eschatological Proplepsis. So let's listen in on Paul.
With the Lord begin your task, Jesus will direct it, etc. Should we give it a try? With the Lord begin your task, Jesus will direct it. For his aid and counsel ask, Jesus will perfect it. Every morn with Jesus rise, and when day is ended, in his name then close your eyes, be to him commended. Today is simply a continuation of all of that. I regard the Lutheran Book of Worship here as a Lutheran take on that ecumenical consensus. That is, a Lutheran version of the consensus that has been arrived at through the last, 50, 60 years in all the churches. And I've been flashing this document and this document both in my sessions this week. This document, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry, representing agreement by leaders of virtually all the major church traditions, Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Old Catholic, Lutheran, Anglican, Reform, Presbyterian, Methodist, United, Disciples, Baptist, Adventist, and Pentecostal. Can you imagine? All of them agreeing as to what baptism is all about, what Holy Communion is all about, what ministry is all about. Now, granted, their churches, individual parishes, individual pastors, individual Christian people may not buy into this. But this is a consensus across the board that we have not seen since before the Reformation. And it is very stirring. Oh, the bell again. Crazy. I've also flashed this book. This is part of a series, Open Questions in Worship, edited by Gordon Lathrop. And I have been a contributor to this volume, What is Contemporary Worship? That's the second in the series. They have the first and the third. The others are not published. What are the Essentials of Christian Worship? That's Gordon's own essay in the first volume. Then this volume, What is Contemporary Worship? Then the third one is out, just recently published, How Does Worship Evangelize? Frank Sen is always worth reading, and he's in that volume. What is changing in baptismal practice? What is changing in Eucharistic practice? What are the ethical implications of worship? What does multicultural worship look like? And how does the liturgy speak of God? Those are the volumes to be published.
Which volume, Paul?
What's that?
Which the volume you're holding there is? Which one is that volume?
This is the second in the series. And as I say, I have been a contributor to this volume, and I want to talk about it, about what I say in this volume in just a moment. Paul Westermeyer and Marion Sawicki are the other authors of this volume. Yeah, it's in the bookstore, and so is volume one, and so is volume three. Okay, let us recall just briefly what I said a couple of days ago, that our tradition is biblical Jewish, it is Catholic, that is to say non-sectarian, it is confessional, national, parochial, and personal. And those loyalties, those traditional loyalties, represent an end-cultural loyalty, a counter-cultural loyalty, and a trans-cultural loyalty. I like those words. They come out of a study by the Lutheran World Federation, as a matter of fact, on worship. And they make the point, which I think is a good point, that our worship ought to be enculturated. That is to say, it ought to reflect the culture in which it's found. So, for instance, African worship, you would expect drums. North European worship, you'd expect German chorales, I suppose. In the inner city, you'd expect different kind of worship from a rural parish in North Dakota, let's say. And you should respect that and cultural setting. However, there's also an aspect that is countercultural. And I think the gospel and certainly our worship also ought to challenge the cultural setting in which it's found. And then finally, transcultural, that's this list here. That is to say, we have a loyalty that extends beyond our present culture and our present age, back to grandpa and grandma and beyond them, and forward to the eschaton, the church in the future. And we ought to keep that loyalty in mind. I gave the definition a couple days ago of tradition as the place where, or the way that, you give grandpa and grandma a vote in the decisions you must make today. And I think that's worthwhile. Okay, having said that, let us sketch out, as I do in the essay in the book that Craig has, let us sketch out what the ecumenical consensus consists of. And this is the way I read that ecumenical consensus. I'm going to have to grab my book back again here for a moment.
Please.
I've got them right here. First of all, the consensus says that Christian worship ought to be Eucharistic. That is to say, it ought to center in word and sacrament. I preached on Wednesday and I held up the Hebrew word devar, which is word and action and thing. And action and thing are the two parts of that word that Lutherans are not too certain about. We're pretty good about word. And we know how to preach and we know how to proclaim and we know how to honor a lectionary, let's say. But ritual action, we're not so good on that. And even less certain about the holiness of things. I like, is it Abraham Joshua Heschel? I think it is, who says, according to the Hebrew understanding of things, everything is holy or not yet holy. I like that. Everything in the world, all the stuff of the world.
Boober, too.
Is that Boober?
Yeah, I think that may be Boober, who.
Okay.
Holy and not yet holy.
It was one of the rabbis, anyhow. All right, I'll say Boober. Everything is holy or not yet holy. And I love that. And we have, this means a sacramental understanding of life. And it's Alexander Schmemann, the Orthodox theologian, who says that the whole world, the cosmos, was created to be the material, the stuff of a cosmic sacrament, and human beings are meant to be the priests of that cosmic sacrament. And that turns me on. I just think that's terrific. So, word and action and thing. The fullest truth about God is not word alone, or word only, or even word chiefly. The fullest truth about God, this is Gordon Latham's word now, the fullest truth about God is word and sacrament. And if we have a service on Sunday morning that does not invite people into word and sacrament both, then we are not inviting them into the fullest truth about God. And that is my gripe with the church growth movement and entertainment evangelism. And those people who want to do something else on Sunday morning other than Eucharist. Christian worship, it seems to me, is Eucharistic. And it trains in sacramental life and sacramental living. And it trains in understanding the stuff and the things of this world and our actions and our lives as sacramental. The shape of the Eucharist, the shape of what happens on Sunday morning, is part of the ecumenical consensus. It's pretty well agreed across the board in a document like this to include a gathering of the people with song and praise and stuff like that. An emphasis and centering and focus on the word by which we live, the story that comes out of Scripture, and three lessons these days. I've even seen ecumenical worship, the Lima service, for instance, that's based on this, with four lessons, law and prophets and epistle and gospel. In the Green Book, it's just Hebrew scriptures and apostolic writing and then gospel. That's word. Then the action, the meal itself. And the meal, as I say, is both action and thing. And the distinctions that I grew up with and that I was introduced to when I went to seminary between sacrament and sacrifice and so on, they're all being obscured these days, very rightly, I think, based on, may I say, the Jewishness of what Jesus does in the upper room. What Jesus does in the upper room is very Jewish. And the ecumenical consensus, again, arguments like transubstantiation and consubstantiation and all that stuff, that's all swept away. You don't hear about that stuff anymore at all in the circles that we're talking about here, because it is agreed and understood that what Jesus is a Jew, and he's giving barakah. He is giving a type of Hebrew prayer over the bread and the cup that is at the same time prayer, that is to say Eucharist, thanksgiving, us to God, but also a rehearsal of God's mighty acts, which is always part of a barakah, which then, because it's a public thing, is also proclamation. It's also sacrament. So it was already the Red Book, if those of you who will remember that far, it was already the Red Book that put the words of institution into a Eucharistic prayer. And I can remember my father, who was a pastor, saying, why are we telling God what he already knows? In the night in which he was betrayed and so on. And there were others who were clucking their tongues about departing from Lutheran practice by putting a Eucharistic prayer here. Well, sure, Luther threw out the Eucharistic prayer because he thought it was irredeemable. And maybe it was in that setting. But we have a new understanding of things. We have access to wider scholarship than Luther had. And a Eucharistic prayer is not only fitting and proper, I would argue that it is pretty close to essential to put the words of institution within a prayer so as to mix up sacrament and sacrifice. What you're doing is praying to God, sure, but other people are listening in. And that's a pattern, may I say, for Christian life. We live our life as a prayer to God in the hope and the expectation that others are listening. Evangelism. Sacrament. So, the meal, that's the third action, and then finally sending. Sending the people out in mission, sending the bread and the cup out to people who are infirm or otherwise homebound and couldn't be part of that celebration, and sending our money and our gifts and our energies out to serve the world. All three of those aspects of sending, I think, are important. Walt Bowman had a neat thing the other night when he said, this is the one, this is the holy, this is the Catholic, and this is the apostolic. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got the four marks of the creed, of the church in the creed, one, holy, Catholic, and apostolic, and there they are. That hadn't dawned on me before. There's consensus in the ecumenical consensus, which you can see here, and which you can see in the Second Vatican Council's document on the sacred liturgy, which has set the ground rules, you might say, for every other denomination to do their take on it, to do their version of it. The architectural setting ought to be one room and not two rooms. And I'm here to tell you, most Lutheran churches are still unmodified two-room spaces. The chancel here, the nave here. And that is fundamentally flawed for Christian worship.
I was pastor of the congregation in 74, 75 that built a building. It was one room, it was wonderful. Wonderful open space, lots of natural light. The community can look at each other, faces and not backs of heads. I wish every church architecture had that.
I'll bet in the days when Holden was a mine that they used the village center as a church and the pastor set up shop in the stage and the pews were all ranked up this way. In fact, I'll bet the early days of the Lutheran occupancy here, they did it that way. And then along came the voices from Vatican II and from worship reform of the last 30 years and so on. And then they put that platform down with the altar right in the middle of the people. Wonderful. That's the way it ought to be, a one-room space. A two-room space is not only hierarchical, suggests a difference, you see, between clergy and lay people. It's even monarchical. I mean, that was the way the Byzantine ruler set up his basilica, and it was always a he, and it's fundamentally flawed, I think.
Now, by two-room, you mean?
Two rooms means nave and chancel.
Symbolically two-room. That you go up and there's a communion rail and all that stuff.
Right. I have church architect friends who even say you shouldn't have a platform for the altar. The altar should be on the same level as the people. Put a big, nice oriental rug underneath it, but don't even put one step up. Have it the same level.
Now, I've been to a Russian Orthodox church where there is literally another room back there.
Oh, yeah, behind the icon screen. Yeah.
And do something and come back out. Yeah.
Again, I've heard person, no less than Alexander Schmemann, say that in the early days in Orthodoxy, it wasn't that way. The icon screen was low. It was just like a little balustrade.
Yeah.
But now, you're right, they have a separate room and there are three little doors and the priest comes out and tells you what's going on every now and then. I mean, it's dreadful. Orthodox, please forgive me. I mean, you've got some homework to do, you Orthodox. But Lutherans have homework to do too, because every little country church in North Dakota and everywhere else is still got an east wall altar. You know what I mean by an east wall altar? The traditional churches were always built oriented toward the east. And the altar was, you know, a little bracket stuck against the wall and the people were lined up like this.
But further back, probably.
Yeah. All the people are back here. Now, as I say, that relates to the Basilica of Byzantine days. The Gothics didn't improve it much. They made it into a shape like a cross, and they did have transepts, but they might have had a divided choir here, where, again, for clergy, they might have had a rood screen. You know what a rood screen is in the Anglican churches? A wooden, it's a permeable screen. I mean, they got holes in it, and it's wood and decorated. But in the Orthodox Church, you're right, it's a solid wall with three little doors. Door here and a door here and a door here. Anyhow, I would maintain, and not just me, but I think others in the ecumenical consensus would agree, that that kind of an arrangement is fundamentally flawed. Rudolf Schwarz, you ought to look at the book, Architecture, what's it? The Church Incarnate, he calls it. And he says there are basically two kinds of churches, axial and radial. And you could argue, theologically, I suppose, that basically this speaks of transcendence, God out there and ahead of us, and this speaks of immanence, God in our midst. And both are good theological categories. So theologically, I couldn't argue with an axial church. But again, one of the other problems with it relates so closely, in our view these days, to a theater. That it gives the impression to people that we are an audience sitting watching a performance. And you may as well have entertainment evangelism then. I mean, that's not good. Kierkegaard long ago, Soren Kierkegaard no less, purity of heart is to will one thing. I think that's the essay. He says, our church architecture contributes to a misapprehension that you're an audience sitting in a theater and a performance. Worship consists of audience and performers. And the worship leaders and the preachers and the pastors, they're the performers. And God is in the prompter's box.
And the so-called mega churches do just that today.
Exactly the same thing.
Brand new.
And it's faulty. It's not the way it should be. What it should be is you should feel invited on stage. When you walk in the door of a church as a worshiper, you should feel invited to be an actor in the drama. You may not want to be, and you may elect to sit in the back pew and just watch. That's your privilege, and we should always respect that in churches. But you should feel invited on stage as a performer. The pastor, the preacher, the organist, the choir, they are the worship leaders. They are the prompters. But the main voice of praise is from the people themselves. It is the people who are, collective noun, holy communion. Not even so much the bread and the cup. The people, they are the holy communion.
Now, this must be a big break from Judaism, where, as I understand it, there is a holy of holies where only certain people go, only the highest priests go.
That's in the temple, that's true. That was true in the temple. I think this relates more to the synagogue. And the synagogue was a development, first century really, first century before Christ perhaps, and then the Christian era. So I think Christian worship takes its roots from the synagogue more than from the temple. But you're right about that. A one-room space, not a two-room space. The architectural signs ought to stand forth clearly, and the chief architectural signs, I call them signs, would be font, ambo, that's pulpit or lectern or whatever you want to call the place where the reading and the preaching takes place, the table or the altar, however you might want to call that. I have no problem with the word table, but I have no problem with the word altar either, it's both. And then the seat of the presider. Gordon Lathrop makes the point that in the early church, the seat of the bishop might have been the more important piece of furniture than the altar. And the seat of the presider, I would like to see that honored over here. In fact, my hope for next year, next week, is to push the furniture around over here in line with some of these principles. Already, they've taken into account some of these principles, but I have another idea that I would love to see tried. The font, a lot of new churches that are being built and a lot of old churches that are being remodeled are giving much more attention to the font. Long overdue. And as Philip Fodiker says, it's at the font and it's in baptism where Lutheran theology has made the biggest contribution to liturgy. We don't have, as Lutherans, we don't have a heck of a lot that's new to say about Holy Communion, but we do have something that's new to say about baptism. Namely, to live out your baptism day by day. I mean, that's a Lutheran thing. And so Lutheran churches and other churches too, when they're remodeling, they're putting in a great big font that you can dunk people in. Certainly dunk babies. That should be standard operating procedure in our churches. Naked baptism of infants. That should be standard operating procedure. And even adults ought to take off at least some garments as a sign that this is the old life that you're rejecting and that you're being born now in a new life. Any of you seen the video, This Is the Night? This wonderful church in, oh, you ought to get a hold of that. Liturgy training. What's Gabe Huck's outfit in Chicago?
In Chicago.
Yeah. He's got it. In fact, I think he may have produced it, but get a hold of it. Show it to your people. It'll blow your mind. A wonderful picture of a lively Roman Catholic parish in Texas where they have a great huge font, and at the Easter Vigil, they baptize adults and infants, taking off their clothes. I mean, it's discreet. They give them a garment to wear. But, I mean, they take off their old clothes, they dunk under the water, they come up on the other side, and they put on a white robe. They're oiled, not just a little dab, but poured over the head, dripping down. Oh, it's marvelous. You should look at that video. It's very, shall I say, primary experience, and then some. Which brings me to number 5, enlarging the sign. We are just coming out of an age of liturgical minimalism. By which I mean people have been obsessed since, what, the 14th century, maybe earlier, with this question. What is the least we can get away with for this to be a valid sacrament? And the unfortunate aberrations of all of that have been the withdrawing of the cup from the people in Roman Catholicism and the individual glasses in Protestantism and the individual wafer as well. Terrible minimalist signs. And Martin Luther, in his reforms, wanted to enlarge the sign. That's a Lutheran term. That's from Luther. He wanted to enlarge the sign. He wanted Eucharist, Holy Communion, in both kinds, bread and cup. So the Lutheran churches began to restore the cup to the people. But we haven't gone very far in the direction of enlarging the sign if we still have individual glasses and if we still have individual wafers. It ought to be one cup and one loaf. And it ought to be a palpably bread and not guppy food. I mean, you know, that wafer looks like nothing that you would see on your table. And it ought to look like bread. And the wine in one cup is irreplaceable symbol, seems to me, at least at the altar. Even if the people cannot be dragged away from their individual glasses, at least the cup on the common cup on the altar reminds the people of the unity that they are willing to deny in their practice. And there are ways, if people are worried about terrible diseases, there are ways of getting around that too. Just take the bread and go back to your seat. Don't take the cup. Or do intinction. I mean, there are lots of different ways other than this way. That if Holden Village's worst enemy had designed the communion system here, it wouldn't be any more terrible than it is. I mean, it's an awful system. Maybe something can be done about that before the eschaton. Okay. Enlarging the sign, low tech too, friends. Do away with all those PA systems and all those microphones and all those woofers and tweeters and electronic mixing boards. Oh, that's terrible. It's the death of worship. Do away with the wall-to-wall carpet too. Americans are obsessed with technology, and it's terrible. I mean, we're not just obsessed with it, we are addicted to it. We should have a 12-step program to, you know, my name is Paul and I am recovering from technological addiction. Most modern technology, of course everything is technology, even a candle is technology, let's face it. But I think the human spirit cries out for primary experience. Nothing mediated. When you put a carpet on the church, on the floor, you're insulating people against hearing an important witness of the click of those heels coming forward to communion.
Yeah, I can't think of his name. One of the Catholic liturgical scholars says that it takes away the harsh carpeting takes away the harsh timber that should really be there in worship.
Darn right.
Not just comfort. I do have a question though about.
Go ahead.
About sound systems, audio yeah. systems. Yeah. What about systems for people who are hard of hearing and?
You're talking to somebody who wears two hearing aids and has an artificial heart valve. I respect technology, and there must be a way to help to have technology help those people. Maybe one way would be to encourage them to sit in the front pews or the front seats. I have very little patience with people who, I can't hear, Pastor, and they're sitting in the back row. I have impatience with pastors, too, who do not learn to project and to speak loudly. These kids, you know, well, adults, too, but teenagers particularly whispering as they lead worship, you know, because that's the way Marilyn Monroe talked.
The little girl who read the lesson or a couple of verses from the Narnia worship on Thursday night spoke
wonderful.
Louder than any of the last several adults have.
She did.
Yes.
But I also, you know, the concern about people who are hard of hearing, that they also go into other situations where hearing is necessary. And I think it also, a lot of people that I know now carry along a supplemental kind of something. They carry along their own little amplification system.
And maybe such things ought to be available in the narthex.
Instead of having the voice projected for everyone, maybe we need to help and provide some extra hearing things for those who are hard of hearing.
But technology not only enlarges your voice, it distorts your voice. I mean, that is a PA system. And if a church is so big that it needs a PA system, it's too big.
The example of the addiction of technology, I'm still amazed. I first noticed it in church assemblies, but now I've seen it in the churches that are doing the high-tech stuff. People will sit in a worship service and watch the screen that's projecting what's happening around the table.
Right?
I've watched that. It is an incredible experience to see that we're so oriented to watching screens that rather than looking
at the real person,
the real
yeah.
thing, we're looking at a screen up here. Of course, it's a close-up, perhaps. Maybe it's a bigger picture, but that's incredible.
Like the woman who's pushing the baby buggy down the street and another woman comes up to her and says, oh, what a beautiful baby. And the woman with the baby buggy and the baby says, oh, this is nothing. You should see his picture.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way we live today.
Do they have instant replay?
The picture of the baby is better than the baby? Incredible. Say it again, Walt.
Turn the instant replay on every Sunday. Just repeat the
same. Wonderful. Technology has its place. I am not a complete Luddite, but I am very suspicious of the addiction that Americans, particularly Americans, Canadians too, have to technology. And there are definite limits to technology, and one of the places where technology ought to be strongly limited, it seems to me, is worship. To get people in touch with what is real and what is authentic. No plastic flowers, please. No silk flowers. It should be real flowers. Real flowers die. And they're supposed to die. No artificial sound, no electronic organ that sounds just like a real pipe organ. Well, it doesn't sound just like a real pipe organ. And if you want, bring in an electric synthesizer, I suppose I'd allow that. But there's nothing like a pipe organ or a guitar or a flute or the real sound. Where did I read something that our children are being brought up without ever having, because they got records and TV and all that and radio, they never hear what a real cello sounds like. They've heard a cello maybe on a record, but it's not the same. Anyhow, primary experience and enlarging the sign and low tech. A devotion or a commitment, this would be the sixth characteristic of the ecumenical consensus, a devotion to the church year calendar and to lectionary preaching. That P in a circle is my own abbreviation for preaching. Preaching ought to be lectionary based. It ought to be based on the scriptures. And the three-year lectionary is now widely accepted across the board ecumenically. Very, very few churches still not bought into it, even officially. And of course, many, many parishes of all denominations where it's completely ignored or unknown. But that's a wonderful gift, that ecumenical three-year lectionary. And now there's a new one.
Yeah, can you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. You want to say something?
No, I want you to say something.
Well, as you may know, it's just now finished a process of revision, and the so-called revised common lectionary, the hope there is that we are brought into sync as Lutherans with Anglicans, Episcopalians, and Roman Catholics. If you have been aware of this, Lutherans have been a couple of weeks off. In other words, we've been reading the same scriptures, but not on the same Sunday. A couple weeks later, a couple weeks earlier, I forget which it is. Anyhow, the new so-called Revised Common Lectionary, RCL. Again, ecumenical committee among all English-speaking Lutherans, among all English-speaking Christians, Freudian slip, among all English-speaking Christians, including Australia, British Isles, and including all the denominations in those, all the Christian denominations in those places, a revised common lectionary and a revised set of liturgical texts, such as the Lord's Prayer. I'm still scandalized. Go into churches, Lutheran churches these days, and they're still using the old Victorian Lord's Prayer. We should be using that new revised translation. It's just more accurate, among other things. So if you're a pastor, train your people to use the left-hand column in the green book and not the right-hand column when it comes to the Lord's Prayer. Anyhow, I'm a member of the Canadian Church these days. I'm an American, but we've been living in Canada for 14 years. This is the ELCIC, Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada's newest resource. You could write to Winnipeg and ask for a copy. This is the revised common lectionary with the lectionary citations, hymns, three collects now, one for each of the years, helps for creating worship, which I myself wrote. I was the author of that section. And then wonderful resources, books, videos, and so on. This ought to be a very, for every Sunday. See, every Sunday has two pages. And every holiday, every feast, every festival. So it ought to be very, very useful. This is being put in the hands of every Lutheran pastor in Canada just this week. And they didn't print up a heck of a lot of them, but you might be able to write to Winnipeg and ask for a copy. Where are we?
There's going to be two copies left here at Holden.
Yes, I'm leaving one copy in Holden Library, and I'm giving the second to, what's his name? Merkel,
will,
Jeff Merkel.
Will the Sundays of Epiphany and after Pentecost be renamed to...
Yes. What we're doing, what the Canadian Church elected to do is Sunday between the 21st of August and the 27th of August, or proper 21.
Okay.
And then the next week is proper 22. This is the way the Anglicans have done it. Proper 22, up the Sunday between August 28 and 3 September. Now, you can still call it the X number after Pentecost if you want to. But this puts us in sync with the others.
Yeah.
And whether you call them Sundays in ordinary time or Sundays after Pentecost or Sunday of the year, you know, those would be three different ways of describing it, but it's the green season. Well, there's a long, long time from May to December. It sure is. All right, church year calendar and lectionary preaching. Preaching in a Lutheran church ought normally to be on the lectionary. The preaching ought not to be on the latest fad or the latest thing in the news or whatever. You ought to take that into account, but we ought to explicate the gospel, it seems to me. Then the tie-in between liturgy and ethics and justice issues. One of the neat things about the Hebrew worship, I had biblical and Jewish up here at the top of my list, you may recall, was the insistence that worship had an ethical tie-in. And justice issues, peace issues, and so on, very, very important. This is now we're getting into eschatological prolepsis. That is to say, people in the Holy Communion are invited to exchange the peace with one another. Even adversaries are to greet one another with a sign of peace. Further, everybody at this meal gets the same. The rich do not get too much to eat. The poor do not leave with too little. Everybody gets a little bit of bread and a little taste of wine. There are justice issues at the heart of this, and we can have as high worship as we want to, but if we ignore the poor and the widow and the oppressed, then we're not within the biblical tradition. And then finally, post-Constantinian, I suggested the other day that our era of emulation, as I would like to call it, is not the 16th century, as a lot of Lutherans think. It's not the 12th century or 10th century, as a lot of Anglicans from the old Oxford movement used to think, and that was what I was brought up in, you see. Back in the days when I was in seminary, it was the Oxford movement, and every church had to look like an English Gothic church and so on. I mean, that, the Oxford movement looked back to that era, the 10th century or the 12th century, as the era of emulation. But this document looks back to the 3rd century or 4th century. And we are living in a it's acknowledging that we are living in a secular, what's the word, pluralistic culture. And we no longer have, the Christian church, that is, and Christian adherents, no longer have the prestige, the power, the privilege that went along with the Constantinian age.
Some would say post-Christian era.
Post-Christian, yeah. I don't like post-Christian. I don't think any era is post-Christian.
Post-Christianity, perhaps.
Post-Christianity, maybe. Post-Constantinian. That's my favorite term. Or post-Christendom. Mm-hmm. Post-Christian, wouldn't you agree with me that post-Christian is not a good word?
Yeah.
Post-Christendom, yes. We're not in Christendom anymore.
We're not established.
We're not established, right. And that's good news, ultimately. The Constantinian era is an embarrassment, for the most part. It's, you know, what, 17 centuries of embarrassment. But, you know, even the Gothic churches, they're magnificent buildings. I've been to Europe, and I've worshipped in them. But they are not adequate for Christian worship. They never were. They are terrific monuments to human creativity, but they're long and narrow, and you can't see and hear, and it's not important, of course, in those days that you saw and hear. You just had to be present, probably telling your rosary while the priest was at the altar, completely out of sight behind some pillar or icon screen or whatever. Again, they're magnificent buildings, but I think they're fundamentally flawed for Christian worship. Okay, now, some principles informing experimental worship. I'd be in favor of experimental worship. Let me quickly tick off some principles informing experimental worship, and they are similar to the principles that come out of the ecumenical consensus. It ought to be sacramental. It should not be word reductionist, but the full truth about God. Word reductionist is my term for the kind of piety that says, well, all you need is words. All you need is prayers and scripture and sermon and song and hymns and that kind of stuff. You don't need action. You don't need stuff. like bread and wine and water. And I'm saying, and I think the ecumenical consensus says, you do. And it's not the full truth of God without it. So a sacramental is faithful to the LBW as a take, a consensus, faithful to the LBW in the sense that it's faithful to this ecumenical consensus. I don't think it has to be this book, but it should not teach contempt for this book. This is one of my problems with a lot of the contemporary worship, and a lot of pastors are coming out of seminary, and they regard this book as the enemy. And it's not the enemy. This book is the envy of many, many denominations. It's a wonderful book. I don't want to idolize it, and I don't want to put it on a pedestal. It's our version of this. Our present contemporary Lutheran version of this. And we can be proud of it. We don't have to be devoted to it, though. And I would say let's have some other resources as well, and let's use other resources. But whatever other resources we use, we should not teach contempt for this. Because this is the church's book. And most people in most churches, most Lutheran churches, have this book in the pew and not another. And every Lutheran church ought to have this book in its pew. It might have other books as well, but it has to have this book, I think. Should not teach contempt for LBW. Ecumenical, again, it should exhibit the current Catholic consensus. It should be participatory. Again, this is Kierkegaard. We're not consumers. We're not observers. We're not an audience. We are actors in the drama. Post-literate. I made that speech the other day. We come into Lutheran churches and a lot of other Protestant churches, too, Catholic churches these days. And they push texts at you, books, pamphlets, even overhead projector. You know, the words to the hymn are on the overhead projector. That freezes out right away a big percentage of the population. The aged with poor eyesight, the illiterate who were never taught to read, little kids who haven't yet been taught to read. We should be conscious that those are part of the Catholic Church as well, Catholic small c. And we should try to design worship that depends on texts as little as possible. And I gave the example a couple days ago of worship in Eastern Kentucky, which was wonderful. Hymns lined out, no text, no books, no bulletins, nothing. Just spontaneous singing on the part of the people. Terrific. Post-literate, demanding no reading, no literacy. Sure, you'll have to sing a hymn from the book. You may have to read a psalm. Even the best psalms, though, are antiphonal-type psalms, where all the congregation has to do is sing a refrain. Like the other night, we praise you and magnify you forever. And then you got a cantor who's literate. And the cantor sings from a book. But the people don't have to have a book. Eat this bread, drink this cup, come to me. I mean, you can learn that, right? In 2 minutes you can learn that. We sang it the other night. That's the best kind of stuff. Okay, low tech, not high tech, primary experience. I made that speech already. Mature, not infantilizing. I made that speech a couple of days ago. A lot of what I see in entertainment evangelism and in the whole tent meeting, revival meeting type of worship is infantilizing. It keeps people babies, and we should stretch them. And people should walk in the door of a church expecting to be stretched a little bit. St. Paul says we are to grow up into mature Christian adulthood. And that's neat. We shouldn't keep them babies. Now, granted, our people are not yet adults in the faith. As newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word. We have to meet people where they are, and I'd be in favor of a certain amount of this kind of stuff, infantilized worship and hymns and a little bit of childlike campfire type stuff even, Bible camp type songs. I think they belong even on Sunday morning, but there also ought to be some good German chorales. And there ought to be something that feeds the mature human being. And human beings are ennobled by the highest and the best, and not by the tacky and the shoddy and the infantile. We may have to use the tacky and the shoddy and the infantile a little bit. But in every service, every Sunday, in every church, there ought to be a generous measure of the highest and the best. To God, the highest and best. To human beings, the highest and best. That's the motto of the Benedictines, and it's on the bottle label of Benedictine booze. Benedictine liqueur has D-O-M. That stands for to God, the highest and best. But not just to God, to people, the highest and best. God doesn't need it. People do. People are fed when they get good stuff. And most of the time they get shoddy stuff, and we are overfed and undernourished in our contemporary culture. Edifying the body, not divisive in the parish. A lot of contemporary stuff is almost introduced to be divisive. We're going to do it contemporary, not like those old-fashioned people who have that green book yet, you know. That's no good. We should introduce whatever is new and experimental in such a way as not to be divisive. And not to be market-driven either. I think targeted worship is terrible. I made that speech the other day. To target worship to a specific population of people, the baby boomers, let's say, or upper middle class whites, is just as terrible as apartheid. I mean, that's what it is. It's liturgical apartheid, separate but equal.
Are you referring to this seeker services?
Seeker services, yeah, that's a liturgical apartheid. I think seekers have to bump up against believers. I think blacks have to bump up against whites. I think middle class have to bump up against lower class and upper class. Straights have to bump up against gays. Little kids have to bump up against adults, and adults against little kids. I mean, that is Catholic. That's the meaning of the word Catholic in my vocabulary. Catholic, small c. The Catholic Church, small c, is all of those people. And if you target worship at just one section or another, something's wrong. Lexington, Kentucky, my daughter lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and there are, what, three or four Lutheran churches there. They just started up a fourth, a black Lutheran church for blacks. And that's kind of sad. I mean, it's back to Jim Crow. Wouldn't it be nice, in other words, if the blacks in Lexington would feel welcome at the white churches? Apparently they don't, and they have their own black church now. I just wonder if whites are going to feel welcome there. You know, I heard an anthropologist say this. There is no society in the world so segregated as North American society. Not just in terms of black versus white, but old versus young. We spent some time in Europe, Kathy and I and our family, and we were amazed at these public piazzas, squares, public park, where old and young and little kids and middle class and obviously lower class. I mean, they were all mingled together. It was wonderful. And it was a picture of the Catholic community. And I yearn for that in America, and I yearn for that in the church. And may I say, a lot of times the church is the only place in the community where you can find that diversity. PhD kneeling at the communion alongside a freshman. Let me tell you, from my years in campus ministry, PhDs do not speak to freshmen, as a rule. And the English department doesn't speak to the engineering department, right? I mean, we live in a terribly segregated society. And the Christian church has an opportunity here to show this unity and diversity, and it doesn't do that, and it's a shame. Enlarging the sign, primary experience, and justice, I've already mentioned them. Okay, eschatological prolepsis. Who can tell me the nine divisions of theology? Theology, cosmology, anthropology. If you're teaching a course in theology, you've got to know all this, you see. Here's one you didn't know. Hamartiology. That means sin, study of sin. This is God, of course. This is the cosmos and the creation. This is human beings. This is the study of sin. This is the word you might be more familiar with, soteriology. Savior, Christ's work as Savior. Then Christology, I'm going to use the abbreviation there, which is Chi. Christology is the person of Christ. Soteriology is the work of Christ. Christology is the person of Christ, who Christ is in relation to Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and all that stuff. What would this one be?
Work of the Spirit.
Spirit, very good. How about this one?
Church.
The church, right. And finally, ta-da! Eschatology is the end. An end, not just punct, but end, consummation, fulfillment, purpose. What is God's purpose? What is the fulfillment of all of this stuff? Those are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, I got them all. Anyhow, eschatology is a study of the end in the sense of purpose and consummation and fulfillment. And prolepsis means a preview of that. And as I suggested earlier, worship ought to be an eschatological prolepsis. It ought to be an anticipation in the here and now of what God promises in heaven. And Christopher Stendhal says that one of the scandals of Jesus to his contemporaries was that he dared to do that. He said, I'm not waiting for the coming of the Messiah. I'm not waiting for heaven. I'm not waiting for the kingdom to come. I'm going to do it now. It was only God who was supposed to forgive sins, and it was only after you were dead in the life to come. And Jesus says, no, I'm going to forgive sins, and I'm going to do it now, and I'm going to give my followers the authority to do it now. And that's what put him on the cross, among other things. A Christmas tree is an eschatological prolepsis. The legend is that Martin Luther took it inside the house, cut down a tree, put it in the house, and put on flowers and fruit as a sign that spring was on the way. Ritually, that is an eschatological prolepsis. You put up a Christmas tree and you decorate it with flowers and fruit as a sign that spring is here, even though there's still snow on the ground. A Vesper candle, and supremely the Vesper candle of Easter, that is the Paschal candle, is an eschatological prolepsis. You ever see Fiddler on the Roof, where Goldie lights the Sabbath lamps as an eschatological prolepsis, anticipation of the coming of the next day. And it's only a little flame, but that flame stands for the sun that is surely going to rise the next day. So the Hebrew day begins with sundown and the lighting of that lamp the day before. That's eschatological prolepsis. And worship ought to encourage in Christian people a thought and an instinct and an attitude and a determination to live out life as eschatological prolepsis. We ought to be living today as if the kingdom were already here. And that we ought to see that in worship. Again, the pox, I think, is one example. The sending out of the bread and the cup is an example. The fact that everybody gets the same, rich and poor, that's a sign of the shalom of God. I've talked enough, too much. Some more comments.
Is this consensus? I have a hard time seeing that the Baptists and the Pentecostals really buy it.
They'd be pretty few and far between, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean it.
That's what this says, and I would be curious to know who those theologians were representing those traditions.
But didn't they rely very heavily on Bill Lazarus to write?
Yeah, Bill Lazarus was one of the framers of this doctrine.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're lying when they say that on the back cover. I would like to know who those theologians are. Now, as a matter of fact, I have traveled in some of these circles, and you have too, perhaps, Craig. I have served on the board of the Liturgical Conference, which is a wide ecumenical thing, chiefly Roman Catholic, but it has, for instance, Methodist. James White, have you ever read any books by James White? Mm-hmm. He's terrific. Now, most Methodists never heard of him or never heard of the stuff that he talks about, but he talks about this same stuff that I'm talking about.
What's interesting is to read the responses to the document of the churches, and then you'll get to see, you know, there were official responses. Some traditions did not respond in the way that others did, and that's the question. But it's as close as one can come to consensus, to imagine consensus of the Christian churches.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right, it's not.
And some churches have more homework to do than others. Again, I think the Southern Baptists and the...
Well, we do too as Lutherans, though.
Do we ever? Absolutely.
I mean, if we, in fact, in all of our congregations, had an understanding of number two, of gathering, word, meal, and sending, we'd be way ahead of where we are.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Paul.
Something else? Yeah. Bell has a word, hasn't it?
Again, I do not recall his name. I believe he's this very well-known Roman Catholic on the liturgy writer. If I didn't have my cold and my head were square, I probably would remember his name.
Aidan Cavanaugh.
He's
the superstar in liturgy these days.
I believe, if I recall, it's Aidan Cavanaugh who says that Christian worship is not to be understood by the general population. Because he says, we have an attitude now shaped chiefly by our consumerist society that when people come to worship, it ought to be understandable.
Immediately accessible,
And he says that ought not to be the case, that people need to be initiated,
right, absolutely.
Will you comment on that?
Yeah, I think I see what he's trying to say, and I think I agree with him maybe 80%.
Yeah.
And now there's a part of me that says what St. Paul says, namely, the stranger ought to come into our worship and be able to say amen. In other words, there ought to be something there in our worship that a complete atheist, a complete stranger to all of this tradition, should be able to affirm. There ought to be something there that is public in that sense. But I think he's right when he says, sure, you got to be initiated into this. You come to my house as a guest at my table. I'm going to sit you down. I'm going to give you a couple of forks, maybe a couple of knives and spoons, and I'm going to give you a napkin and a napkin ring. And you got to learn how to use that. And you use that by looking around the table and seeing how...